It is Monday, August the 6th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, is there evidence someone tried to assassinate Venezuela's president?
It provides a very confusing situation for Venezuelans and outsiders to interpret.
Some believe that there's bad news ahead for President Trump with the Russia probe.
It's looking like that thread is going to run not just through all of his own people, but right up around the president as well.
Also ahead, Apple's worth $1 trillion, plus a little something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Venezuelan officials are saying the authorities there have detained six people suspected of using explosives-laden drones in a failed bid to assassinate President Nicolas Maduro while he spoke in Caracas during a celebration of the National Guard's 81st anniversary. An unarmed Maduro later spoke on television. I was just saying, let's not let our guard down. And at that very moment, exploding directly in front of me, a flying device, a big explosion. My reaction was of observation, of serenity, because I have full confidence in the people and the armed forces, of their loyalty, and God protects me. The government in Caracas alleged opposition factions conspired with assailants in Miami and Bogota, although they offered no specific evidence. Opposition leaders decried Maduro for broadly singling out his political opponents, and they warned that this might lead to further suppression of his critics. Here in the U.S., National Security Advisor John Bolton spoke about the incident in an appearance on Fox News Sunday.
It could be a lot of things, from a pretext set up by the Maduro regime itself to something else. He's made accusations accusing the outgoing president of Colombia of responsibility, what he calls the extreme right wing in Venezuela. That means the vast opposition to his authoritarian rule. And he's blamed unnamed financiers in the United States. These are things he's said before.
And for some perspective on all of this, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with Jennifer McCoy, Georgia State University Distinguished Professor of Political Science and former director of the Carter Center's Americas program. Dr. McCoy says the reports of what happened are confusing.
The government almost immediately claimed that they had rounded up some people and, you know, had evidence that even Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos was behind this. The Colombian government has denied this. So there are also other reports that it could have been an accidental explosion from a gas line in the surrounding neighborhood, or the drone just covering a military parade that was happening, going off course, and so military security shot it down. So it provides a very confusing situation for Venezuelans and outsiders to interpret.
Mr. Maduro, of course, addressing members of the security forces who were in formation at the time, and the video shows a rather strange progression of events that once these explosions took place, the soldiers actually scattered. Was this an embarrassment to the security forces?
Well, it looked embarrassing, but of course they were there not in combat preparedness, but more as an honor guard standing there watching a speech, and so certainly weren't prepared to act on contingency. But I think that the whole episode shows the vulnerability of this government, of this president, and whether it was an actual intent on him, then it shows the vulnerability of the security because it got fairly close. If it was, on the other hand, as some have alleged, actually staged by the government to rally support, that shows the vulnerability that they're feeling for losing support because of the dire economic situation. So, you know, either way, I think it makes the government weaker and vulnerable.
A little-known group called the National Movement of Soldiers and T-shirts claim responsibility for the explosion. They said that they were describing themselves as uniting members of the resistance to Mr. Maduro, and said they had flown two drones, but snipers shot them down.
Yes, that did come out as a claim. Again, it's very difficult from the outside to evaluate the veracity of that claim of responsibility, as well as what the government has said, blaming the foreign governments. It's, I think, possible that there was an internal attack, an attempt coming from inside Venezuela, because there's great dissatisfaction with the government, not only among the population who are suffering terribly from hyperinflation, but also from within the military and security forces. Many troops have been deserting, and the government has been purging the military to try and ensure loyalty, and so getting rid of potential critics.
Do you think this could have been a staged event to make Mr. Maduro look stronger or to make sure that he stays in power?
Well, I do think that the government's primary goal is to stay in power and that they will do whatever it takes to stay in power. And my fear is that they will use this, whether it was staged or not, that they will use this as an excuse for a further crackdown, further repression on critics or dissidents within the country.
This does show a weakness in the government. Does it portend something that perhaps we're reaching a tipping point in Venezuela?
It's very difficult to say. People have predicted for years that earlier that Chavez would fall in reaction to major protests or strikes by the opposition early in his tenure, and for Maduro as well, that he would fall because of the very precarious financial and economic situation of the country. However, many make parallels to Zimbabwe, where Robert Mugabe stayed in power for years, even with inflation estimated at over 1 billion percent, which is even hard to fathom. So it's, you know, with repression, with the Venezuelan government cowing its own people, intimidating them from protesting and, you know, forcing them to basically spend their time searching for food and medicine, it is possible that it could stay in power for some time. It's very difficult to predict.
Jennifer McCoy, a professor of political science at Georgia State University. She was also former director of the Carter Center's Americas program, and she was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. President Trump has renewed his attack on the U.S. investigation into whether Russia interfered in the 2016 U.S. presidential election and whether Mr. Trump or anyone from his campaign colluded with Moscow to guarantee a Trump win. AP's Tim McGuire is following the story.
In a Sunday tweet, President Trump writes, "A June 2016 Trump Tower meeting in which his son met with a Russian lawyer was totally legal." Jay Sekulow, one of Trump's personal lawyers, tells ABC's This Week there's no evidence Trump has broken the law.
What violation has anybody put forward of an actual federal statute that's been violated by the President of the United States?
California Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff disagrees, telling CBS Face the Nation,
"I think there's plenty of evidence of collusion or conspiracy in plain sight."
Schiff says it's special counsel Robert Mueller's job to lay out exactly which laws may have been broken. Tim McGuire, Washington.
U.S. Special Counsel's Russia investigation appears to some to be rattling the president, evidenced by his tweets. Mr. Trump dictated that it's been described as a misleading statement a year ago about the meeting his son held in Trump Tower. Donald Trump Jr. later acknowledged the meeting was set up on the premise that the Trump campaign would be getting incriminating information about Hillary Clinton, who was Donald Trump's opponent in the 2016 election. President Trump has called news accounts a complete fabrication and expressed concern about the legal liability for his son. Mr. Trump's latest denial that he knew ahead of time about the meeting comes in the face of news reports that are saying his former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, is prepared to tell the special counsel he heard Donald Trump Jr. tell his father in advance about the meeting. VOA's Lori London asked Jack Rice, former Central Intelligence Agency officer and now a criminal defense attorney, for his legal perspective on these recent developments.
It's really amazing when you see just how far this has moved. When the investigation broke on this, the Trump team said there was no meeting. And then eventually what they said was, okay, there was a meeting, but the president knew nothing about it, and what it had to do was Russian orphans. And then it wasn't Russian orphans anymore. And it may have had to do with a dirt on Hillary Clinton. But again, the president knew nothing about this. Then we hear that the president knew something about this, but only after the fact. And then we actually learned in the last couple of days that the president has decided that not only did he know that it wasn't just about orphans, but that it was actually about dirt on Hillary Clinton, and he actually knew about the meeting, not just afterward, but actually before, and actually dictated the response back. It's really an astounding evolution of events.
A lot of lawmakers are really concerned about the upcoming midterm elections. Our intelligence community has already said that Russia has continued to work toward interfering and will be doing that in the midterms. The president has so far continued outwardly to call this whole thing a hoax and a witch hunt, but he did have all of his intelligence community, national security leaders, come out last week and talk about the fact that the White House is on it, that they are aware that Russia is doing this, that Russia is continuing to do this, and they are working to fix it. They didn't really give any specifics. But then we heard the president at a rally that evening going back to calling it a witch hunt. What are we to believe at this point?
That's the difficulty. That's the confusion. And in some ways, that's the dichotomy that we really have. We had all of U.S. intelligence at the White House talking about the U.S. in the crosshairs. Not only did this happen in 2016, but it's going to happen again, and the Russians are actually looking at this issue right now for the 2018 elections. And so you get that sort of frontal approach, and then you have the president turn around and call this a witch hunt and a hoax just the very same evening. And 2 weeks before, he's standing next to Vladimir Putin in Helsinki saying the very same thing, seemingly standing seamlessly with the Russian leader rather than with his own people. So the problem that we have right now is he's saying one thing, but fundamentally, U.S. is doing something else. And I think that's what's causing so many people high blood pressure.
As somebody who is a criminal defense attorney and a former member of the Central Intelligence Agency, do you think that this goes beyond President Trump just feeling like if he admits to election interference in 2016 that it delegitimizes him as president? Or do you think there's more to it and that there's something here we still don't know about the relationship between President Trump and Russia?
You know, this so much goes to guessing at this point. It really does. There's the part of me watching this as a former CIA officer and as somebody who's worked in the legal world for decades. I see this. He's pushing back because he doesn't want to delegitimize his presidency. But at the same time, I'm watching this, and I'm watching all of the machinations of his own people, including his son, fundamentally neck deep involved in this. And I think that there's very real concern and fear in his eyes when it comes to the issue of the conspiracy they may have committed in support of him, even if he weren't involved. But the real question, in addition to all of their efforts, it's whether or not the president himself actually knew and was involved too. And based upon his general behavior throughout the entire presidential cycle, running up to the presidency, winning the election, and his actions since, it strikes me as unlikely that he would have simply allowed all of this to happen blindly, because he has his fingers in everything that's going on. It was such a small operation, and it was so haphazard of the players involved. I can't imagine that he wasn't involved in this either. And so if you start pulling on this thread of this sweater, it's looking like that thread is going to run not just through all of his own people, but right up around the president as well. Of course, the bottom line is that everybody has to prove it.
Jack Rice is a former CIA officer, now a criminal defense attorney. He was speaking with VOA's Lori London.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News.
And it turns out that Apple, the world's first publicly traded company, has made it to that valued $1 trillion mark. Milestone marks the latest triumph of the trend-setting company that was started 42 years ago in Steve Jobs' garage. Well, so some perspective on Apple reaching that $1 trillion mark. VOA's David Byrd speaks with Marlon Nichols. He's a founding managing partner with Cross Culture Ventures, and that's in Los Angeles. He asked Nichols what all of this means to Apple as a company and to the consumer.
For Apple as a company, it means its employees and stockholders are a bit richer. I think for consumers, it means you'll continue to see a more diversified set of products that Apple's going to create. Because in order to get to a trillion, you got to have some diversity in the products that you put out in the world. and you're going to have to grow those products, as well as you're going to have to introduce new ones. So, you know, the Apple ecosystem is one that's proven to be very, very sticky. And, you know, from things like games to apps to, you know, now healthcare in the future, self-driving vehicles, et cetera, I think there's a lot of innovation yet to come from the company. And consumers, you know, will have the pleasure of, you know, of experiencing those things.
Apple has kind of hung its fortunes on the iPhone for a while. Tim Cook did come out with the Apple Watch. But a lot of their money recently has come from selling apps and streaming and cloud storage, right?
Yep. And that's, you know, that's where the business is going, right? If you looked at their earnings report, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but, you know, margins were slipping, right? Because if you want to remain competitive with those physical devices, primarily the iPhone, especially as, you know, more and more Android and Samsung devices are coming out to the market and they're catching up, you've got to introduce new products. And for them, you know, just piggybacking on the ecosystem that they've built and the stickiness of that, it's going to come in the form of services. And as they grow those services, I think you can expect the margins to come up. I think they projected something like 38% gross margins overall going forward. And, you know, that's going to be the result of, you know, the revenue coming from services, because it costs less to deliver those services than it does to manufacture a phone. And, you know, you got to remember there are something like a billion iPhones out there on the market already.
And there's also the issue of a blossoming or threatened trade war between the United States and China, China being one of Apple's larger markets in addition to Southeast Asia. How do you think that, along with tariffs on nations like Canada, Mexico, and even on the EU, will affect Apple's future?
Yeah, I don't think that, you know, trade wars are good for anyone involved. You know, our government's got to figure out a way to get that under control. Obviously, if you have to pay more for metals, you know, that's going to increase your BOM, bill of materials on the devices, which I'm assuming, you know, will get passed on to the consumer at some point, and may drive even fewer sales. Going forward, I think Apple's bread and butter is not going to necessarily be as entrenched in devices as it will be in services.
Marlon Nichols is the founding managing partner with Cross Culture Ventures. That's in Los Angeles, and he was speaking with VOA's David Byrd. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Fast radio bursts, or FRBs, are brilliant, powerful, but quick pulses of electromagnetic energy at radio wavelengths. In a posting to the Astronomer's Telegram website, scientists working with the Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment, or CHIME, a radio telescope in British Columbia, Canada, say they spotted an FRB with a frequency as low as 580 megahertz on July 25th. They say this is the first detection of a fast radio burst at radio frequency below 700 megahertz. In a recent tweet, astrophysicist Dr. Emily Petrov says that most of the FRBs detected so far have been found at frequencies between 1,000 to 1,500 megahertz. The CHIME team says that since spotting the July 25th FRB, they also detected but not verified others at even lower frequencies. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us today. Guess what? Time now for a little something from the world of music. The Stylistics are an American soul group that achieved its greatest success in the 1970s. Most of their U.S. hits were ballads characterized by the falsetto sounds of Russell Tompkins Jr. During the early 1970s, the group had 12 consecutive R&B top 10 hits, such as Bet You By Golly Well. Stylistics were created from two groups in the U.S. city of Philadelphia, the Percussions and the Monarchs. Russell Tompkins Jr., James Smith, and Aaron Love came from the Monarchs, and James Dunn and Herbie Morrell came from the Percussions. And what a sound they conjured up! Sing Baby Sing was one of their more upbeat songs. After signing with Avco Records in the early 1970s, the record label approached producer Tom Bell, who had already produced a catalog of hits for the Delphonics, to work with the Stylistics. Initially, Bell was unimpressed with the group, but came around because he believed in the potential of lead singer Russell Tompkins Jr. and his distinctive nasal-high tenor and falsetto voice, evidenced so well in the Stylistics' hit, I'm Stone in Love with You. Stylistics are still out on the road performing to sold-out audiences, and two of the original group members, Aaron Love and Herbie Morrell, are still center stage along with the new members, Jason Sharp and Bo Henderson.
Meaning.
wondered how you could scare Wall Street to death. Well, I'd love to know how sometimes, let me tell you. Enough about that. Hey, listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. Up next, the latest world news, and we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday, and now listen to a little more from The Stylistics.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross and a delegation from the President's Advisory Council on Doing Business in Africa announced over $1 billion in private sector deals during their recent mission to four sub-Saharan African nations. The Advisory Council members expect to quickly conclude more than $2 billion in additional deals in the coming days. The four-nation visit, which included stops in Ethiopia, Kenya, and Cote d'Ivoire, concluded in Ghana, where Secretary Ross signed a Memorandum of Understanding with the Minister of Finance to deepen the commercial partnership between the two nations. On previous stops, Undersecretary of Commerce Gilbert Kaplan signed a cooperative agreement with the Ethiopian and Kenyan governments. In Ghana, Secretary Ross led the U.S. delegation in meetings with President Nana Akufo-Addo, Vice President Mamoudou Bawumia, Minister of Trade Alan Karamatin, Minister of Energy Boaki Agyarko, and Minister of Finance Ken Ofori-Atta. Undersecretary Kaplan led the delegation in Ethiopia, Kenya, and Cote d'Ivoire, meeting with heads of state and senior government officials, including Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta, President Alassane Ouattara, and Prime Minister Amadou Gon Coulibaly of Cote d'Ivoire, and Ethiopian Minister of Finance Abraham Tekesti. The delegation also met with business leaders and U.S. companies already doing business in those markets. The delegation also met with officials at the African Development Bank to better understand how and where the bank is providing financing throughout the continent. This financing is a key tool for U.S. companies as they seek procurement contracts. Cooperation agreements signed during the trip with Ethiopia, Kenya, and Ghana identify priority projects in key sectors to help achieve long-term growth and development. The cooperation agreements also establish a forum for the governments to address and resolve business climate challenges that limit participation by U.S. companies seeking to invest or do business in the three countries. The United States is making real progress in Africa, and we remain a strong, long-term, and stable partner in the continent's economic development, said Secretary Ross. We are finding solutions to transition aid-based economies to trade-based economies by creating new pathways for mutually beneficial long-term partnerships.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.